From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Sam Cooke started out as a gospel singer and crossed over to make such hits as You Send Me, Wonderful World, and We're Having a Party. He also wrote and produced music and started his own record label. But his life came to a sudden and shocking end when he was murdered in 1964. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with his biographer, Peter Gorelnick. His book about Cooke, Dream Boogie, is now out in paperback. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews the new independent film Mutual Appreciation by the same director who brought us Funny Ha Ha, a film that was on many critics' top 10 lists. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Sam Cooke was a celebrated soul singer who also produced his own records and started his own record label, long before that was common. In a few minutes, we'll hear an interview Terry Gross recorded with Peter Guralnick, whose biography of the late singer has just been released in paperback. It's called Dream Boogie. Guralnick is also the author of a noted two-part biography of Elvis Presley and has written extensively on soul, blues, and country music. Sam Cooke is best known for his hits from the 50s and 60s, like You Send Me, Having a Party, Wonderful World, and Chain Gang. But before he sang soul music, he sang gospel and spent 6 years at Specialty Records with the gospel group The Soul Stirrers. When Cooke crossed over, his success encouraged other gospel singers to try secular music. Let's begin with a taste of the Sam Cooke sound before he went to secular music. Here he is with The Soul Stirrers in 1954.
One of these I'm going away any day now. I'm going to heaven to stay. Maybe morning, night or noon, but I'm going to see the Father and by His side. No sadness, just only complete gladness. But any day, I know that I am a hallelujah.
Sam Cooke recorded in 1954. Before we hear Terry's interview with music writer Peter Guralnick, let's listen to how Sam Cooke's gospel style translated into soul music. This is You Send Me, his first hit, which climbed all the way to number one in 1957.
Darling, you send me. Honest you do, oh, you thrill me. I know you thrill me. Darling, you thrill me. Honest you do. At first I thought it was infatuation, but it's lasted so long. Now I find myself wanting to marry you and take you home.
Peter Guralnick, welcome back to Fresh Air. This is the song that Sam Cooke crossed over with from gospel to pop. What did it mean to Cooke to cross over and to have, you know, a number one song on the pop charts?
For it meant tremendous fear and tremendous relief. I mean, the greatest barrier to Sam Cooke crossing over was not so much a religious concern. He never left the church. He never left gospel music. He continued to sing gospel music until the day he died and to write gospel songs. So it really wasn't a matter of challenging his faith. And he had been brought up by his father to look for the opportunity. I mean, his father was a member of a striving generation, part of the Great Migration to Chicago and someone who really taught his children to get ahead, that you didn't, whether you made your living by singing or shining shoes, that had nothing to do with your dedication to God. Sam's father, incidentally, was a minister, the Reverend Charles Cook, in the Church of Christ Holiness. But for Sam, the great fear was that he wouldn't succeed. He knew what he had in gospel music. He had come up against an economic wall. He had come up against a wall in terms of the success that he could see for himself, and he didn't want to stop with that wall. He, from Sam's point of view, there was no end to his ambition. But at the same time, there was that kind of fear that any of us might feel, that what if I do this and I don't succeed? And the great fear was that if he didn't succeed, if he failed in pop music, that he would never be able to go back to gospel. He would never be accepted again.
How did You Send Me become that first song? I know he'd recorded another secular song on a small label, but this was the song that really crossed over. It's an original of his. Is there a story behind the song?
There are a lot of stories behind the song. But the story behind its success, or how it got chosen, was that Sam had actually made a number of attempts in the nine or ten months prior to his recording session in the spring of 57, in June 1st of 57, at which he recorded You Send Me. Now, he had been writing songs for a good while. He'd been writing songs all through 1956, not at first with the idea of recording them himself. And then when he made the decision to leave the Soul Stirrers, he put a number of those songs and a couple of other songs down on tape, sent them out to his producer, Bumps Blackwell, in California, with just him playing guitar. And among those songs was You Send Me. When they went into the studio, they recorded You Send Me in Summertime as the potential single. And it was Summertime. It was Sam's arrangement of George Gershwin's Summertime that both Sam and Bumps Blackwell believed was the A-side of the song. You Send Me was a very peculiar hybrid. And it was a song that when Sam first sang it for his guitarist, Cliff White, the guitarist who played on the You Send Me session and then continued with Sam up until his death, when Sam first played it for Cliff, Cliff said, "I thought the guy was joking. He just kept singing the same words over and over and over again. I thought he'd lost his mind or something." And when it finally came to the release, Cliff said he breathed a sigh of relief. He said, "Well, he finally got out of that, that repeated phrase." But again, Sam had a very strongly developed aesthetic, and one element of it was simplicity. And he believed that every song ought to be accessible, that it ought to be something, the melody ought to be something that the man on the street could hum, and the lyrics should be something that were written in plain enough language so everybody could pick up on them, and that they would tell a story plainly and directly. So when the single came out, You Send Me and Summertime, Sam and Bumps went out on the road still with the idea that Summertime would be the hit. And they went around to visit DJs. This was on a promotional tour, not a performance tour. And virtually every DJ said, turned the record over and said, "This is the hit. You Send Me is the hit."
My guest is Peter Guralnick, and he's written a new biography of Sam Cooke. It's called Dream Boogie, and Peter's also the author of a two-volume biography of Elvis Presley. Peter, how do you think Sam Cooke's gospel singing compared to his pop singing?
I think in some ways it compared very directly, in other ways it contrasted. I think the comparison is that Sam learned, he was inclined very early on, and he learned very early on that his strength, his mark, was really in lowering the volume. The first show that he did, or the first program he did with the Soul Stirrers in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, when he was just 19 years old, he was blown off the stage by the Pilgrim Travelers and the Five Blind Boys, by their showmanship, by the way in which Archie Brownlee and the two leads for the Pilgrim Travelers just shouted, and he attempted to do that and failed. And both S.R. Crane, the Soul Stirrers manager, and J.W. Alexander, who was the manager for the Pilgrim Travelers and a kind of mentor to Sam from an early age, and who became his was his friend and became his business partner several years later. Both Crane and J.W. Alexander counseled Sam, rely on your strengths. Your strength is in the unique way in which you sang, the unique way in which you can draw the listener to you. You can draw the congregation to you. And that was the basis for Sam's gospel style, was this kind of crooning style. It was a seductive style. That was what he brought to pop music. That's what I think is so extraordinary about his transition to pop music, and was what both Bumps Blackwell, his producer, and what J.W. Alexander, and what this DJ in Newark who managed Roy Hamilton, Bill Cook, all saw in him. They saw the potential for a teenage singing idol. J.W. Alexander felt that Sam was the first black performer, rhythm and blues performer, who had the potential to really be a matinee idol for teenagers, black and white, and for whom the category didn't have to exist. This depended to some extent on Sam's looks, because he was an extraordinarily good-looking man. But it also depended on the manner of his singing, which was not challenging, was not threatening, and didn't require a tremendous adjustment on the part of a white audience to what he was presenting.
Peter Guralnick speaking with Terry Gross. Guralnick's biography of Sam Cooke is called Dream Boogie. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to Terry's 2005 interview with Peter Guralnick about singer Sam Cooke. Before we get back to the interview, let's hear Cooke's 1962 hit, Having a Party.
We're having a party, dancing to the music played by the DJ on the radio. The Cokes are in the icebox, popcorn's on the table. Me and my baby, we're out here on the floor. So Mr. DJ, keep those records playing, 'cause I'm having such a good time dancing with my baby.
One of the paradoxes in Sam Cooke's life is that, you know, he comes out of the gospel circuit. He's singing, you know, he's singing sanctified songs. And then, I mean, he becomes a kind of a drinker, a gambler, lots of women in his life. How did he reconcile this kind of contradiction?
Probably the same way that almost every other gospel singer and many ministers do. He wasn't really a gambler. He was a bad gambler.
Okay.
He gave the money back if he ever won, and he didn't win much of the time. The drinking, I think, was something that as a kid he probably didn't do all that much and became much more pronounced after the death of the drowning of his son Vincent at 18 months in the spring of 1963. But the women, Sam always had a very active social life from the time he was quite young. And I would say the women were always a part of that life. And I think if you examined, I think it's just it's the range of human activity. I don't think you'll find any less sexual activity in the church in general than you will in the world at large, and certainly not within the gospel world. So I think that without sin there'd be no salvation, and I think that there was always hope of salvation.
Did it bother him that he was a sinner? Did he think of himself as a sinner?
You know, I doubt that. I would say Sam had a more analytic approach to life. I don't think he was satisfied with easy solutions or I don't think he would categorize himself in that way. I think he would perhaps take a broader view that all of us are sinners in different ways. And I would imagine the thing that would have bothered him most of all, although I certainly don't have any evidence of this, was the difficulty that he had in expressing emotion outside of his music, the difficulty he had in a sense in owning up to the way that he felt, to the conflicted feelings that he might feel, not sinning feelings, but just because he was so charming, he was so charismatic, and he felt the burden, I think, of carrying that image with him everywhere he went, not simply for the general public, but even with the other performers that he traveled with. And I think the burden of keeping his feelings inside is something that many of those closest to him remarked upon. I mean, that was what was most extraordinary about researching this book, or meeting all the people who were closest to Sam. Bobby Womack, who was Sam's protege, who was just an 18 or 19-year-old when he started playing with Sam, said that Sam told him if he felt bad, he just didn't go out of his room because he didn't want to put that burden on anybody.
Another way in which Sam Cooke was groundbreaking is that he co-founded and co-owned a record label, that he started with his friend and business partner, J.W. Alexander. Why did he want that?
It really stemmed from an innate sense of black pride and self-determination, which was something. He was a student of black history at a time when the term didn't exist. He was someone who had been brought up by his father to believe that you should respect yourself most of all, never allow anyone to disrespect you, but respect yourself most of all. He realized very early on the same thing that many performers, both black and white, recognized, which is that he did not own the fruits of his own labor, that other people were making money off of his creative endeavor, and that, in fact, particularly with respect to songwriting, that this was really where the money was and where the money still is today in the music business, is both in writing and publishing songs. And when he switched over, from Specialty Records to Keen Records, with his first pop record under his own name, You Send Me, Bumps Blackwell, who was managing him and producing him at that time, told him, Sam, when you go over to Keen Records, you're going to own your own publishing, and that means we're going to make a lot more money. Well, it didn't happen. Bumps was going on a nod and a wink, or perhaps just on wishful thinking. And eventually, J.W. Alexander, who had set up his own publishing company in the summer of 1958, and kept bugging Sam, like, come on, you've got to have your own publishing. They're never going to pay you if you don't have your own publishing. J.W. Alexander won Sam over, and at the beginning of 1959, he went into partnership with J.W. in this publishing company. And that was really the genesis of a creative rebirth on his part. He started writing songs like crazy in the early part of 1959, just writing one song after another, essentially to demo them for other singers, and with the idea that they would be recorded by other singers. And the outgrowth of that, some 9 months later, was the startup of a record company, SAR Records, S-A-R, which J.W., Sam, and S.R. Crane at the beginning formed specifically to record the Soul Stirrers, who had been cut loose from their recording contract at that time, but ultimately to record, as J.W. said, people they liked both in terms of their music, people they liked personally, and essentially to give expression, untrammeled expression, to an artistic vision that Sam and J.W. to a lesser extent both had.
So was Sam Cooke recording for RCA at the same time that he had his own record label?
Yeah, no, he was. Sam Cooke, I think very wisely, determined that he needed a record company with greater capital or capitalization than his own record company could give him. He needed the promotion that a full-scale record company could give him. So he started recording for RCA in January of 1960. And that was almost precisely the time that he started recording new artists other than the Soul Stirrers for his own Sire Records. And virtually every session was produced by Sam Cooke, and you can hear Sam producing these sessions you can hear him teaching the song to different artists on the album, the Sire Records Story, on the two CD set, the Sire Records Story.
All right, Jim, I'm back on you now. I want you in hell. I'm gonna holler at you.
Gethsemane.
Gethsemane. Lest I forget thine agony.
Thine
shall the soul.
Thine shall thy glory be.
Redeem.
Lest I forget.
Lest
the glory be.
Thy glory be.
Thine shall thy glory be. No, thine shall the thine. Glory be.
That's right.
Thine shall the glory be. Can't be thine shall thy glory be.
Yeah, I shall be thy glory.
No, no.
Okay.
Thine.
Okay.
Wait a minute, no, yeah, let me
get the sense of it now.
Thine means yours.
Uh-huh.
Yours shall the glory be. It ain't the glory ain't mine. It belongs to you.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Thine shall the glory be. You know what I'm saying? Okay. It means the glory belong to you. It don't belong to me.
Thine shall thy. Thine shall. Okay.
Yeah. It means I'm giving all the glory to you. I'm giving all
the
glory.
That's good.
I don't want none.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, and we're in business. Here we go.
Lead me to Calvary.
Peter Guralnick's biography of Sam Cooke, Dream Boogie, is now out in paperback. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Don't know much about
history. Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, available in stores and online at bn.com. From Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created by Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding. And from Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
If you ever change your mind.
Coming up, the tragic death of Sam Cooke. We continue our conversation with his biographer, Peter Guralnick. His book, Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke, is now out in paperback. Also, David Edelstein reviews the new independent film, Mutual Appreciation.
Yeah, 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 yeah. I know I laughed when you left, but now I know I only hurt myself. Hey, hey. Bring it to me. Bring your sweet loving. Bring it all.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. We're listening back to Terry's 2005 interview with Peter Guralnick, whose biography of soul singer Sam Cooke, called Dream Boogie, is now out in paperback. Cooke's hits from the 1950s and 60s include You Send Me, Only 16, Wonderful World, Chain Gang, Twistin' the Night Away, and Another Saturday Night. To understand what a great singer he was, you need to also hear his early gospel records and some of his lesser-known soul recordings, like this one, which was reissued last year. Here's Lost in Lookin' from Cooke's 1963 album Nightbeat.
I'm lost and a-lookin' for my baby. Wonder why my baby can't be found.
I'm lost and I'm looking for my baby. Lord knows my baby ain't around. So I'm lost and I'm looking for my baby. Wonder why my baby can't be found. Lost and a searching for my baby. Lord knows my baby ain't around. Crying for my baby, crying all alone, calling for you. Come home, come home. I'm lost and I'm calling for my baby. Baby, won't you please come home? I'm lost and I'm calling for my baby. I need you 'cause I'm so alone.
Sam Cooke, recorded in 1963. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Cooke's biographer, Peter Guralnick.
It was in 1964 that Sam Cooke was shot to death in just an incredibly pointless, tragic shooting. And I'm sure you've done a lot of research about how this happened, because there's always been a lot of questions surrounding what really happened. So could we just, like, reconstruct a little bit what happened that night? He went to a cheap hotel with another woman. Who was the woman?
The woman was a prostitute named Elisa Boyer, whom he met earlier in the evening at a restaurant in Hollywood. And she was a very attractive. She was referred to in the press, in the black press anyways, Eurasian, and a very attractive young woman. And it wasn't, this was not out of character for Sam. He actually had, was committed to the idea. He told Bobby Womack, get yourself a high hooker. Just don't mess with your fans, because over the years, his involvement with his fans had caused him a lot of trouble, caused them a lot of trouble, and caused him, in his view, a lot of money. So from his point of view, it was far more practical to go with a prostitute. And this was something, oddly enough, that his wife Barbara also endorsed. So I think the greatest, he went to the motel with this woman. She, according to the private investigator's report, her modus operandi was not altogether straightforward. She got her client to go into the bathroom to take a shower and clean himself up. And while he was in the bathroom, she would make off with his clothes, his wallet, his credit cards, and everything else. And I think the assumption was that the client was either drunk enough or would be embarrassed enough not to pursue her. Well, Sam was neither, as it turned out, and ran out of the ran after her, believed that she had gone into the motel manager's apartment office when she saw him after her, banged on the door, eventually broke the door down, and whether Elisa Boyer was there or not, I mean, according to the court testimony, she wasn't, but whether or not she was, Sam did not believe that she was not there, and was threatening enough so that the motel manager, Bertha Franklin, pulled out a gun and shot him.
And when he burst into her office, it sounds like he was wearing his jacket and his shoes, which were the clothes that were left behind.
Yeah, he seems to have had one shoe on, although I can't quite picture that, but yeah, he had a jacket and a shoe on. And
that was probably all he was wearing.
Yeah, no, exactly. So, I mean, this was not the kind of thing that would inspire confidence on the part of anyone that they were dealing with a reasonable person.
And the motel manager probably didn't know who he was.
I tend to think she did know who he was. She said in her testimony she didn't, but I find that difficult to believe. But whether she did or she didn't, it made him no less threatening. it's, you know, a terrible end to a noble life. And I, what I think is more significant, though, than his death. And to some extent, you can see this as part of a piece. It was in Sam's character never to back down when he felt he was being taken advantage of. It was what his father had taught him, and it shows up all through his life. And, I mean, if you think about it, the previous year, he had come to Shreveport, arrived at at the new Holiday Inn in town, which had a policy, supposedly, of despite the rigid segregation in the South, Holiday Inns across the country said they had adopted an integrated policy. When Sam showed up, the manager said, no, we don't have a reservation for you. In that situation, Sam became so enraged and started yelling and swearing at the manager of the motel and against the entreaties of his brother Charles, his road manager, S.R. Crane, who had been with the Soul Stirrers, and his wife, Barbara. He would not be pulled away. And his wife kept saying to him, Sam, they're going to kill you. And Sam just said, they're not going to kill me. I'm Sam Cook. And Barbara said, to them, you're just another N-word. But in that, let's say Sam had gotten killed in that situation, it would have been for much the same reason, because he simply, it's like he just flashed, and he couldn't back down. And it would be an entirely different story, obviously. I mean, he would be martyred, in a sense, to the forces of prejudice, to the forces of segregation. But essentially, it would have been for the same reason. And it's a peculiar thing. I think that, the most significant aspect of it is that the black community to this day simply cannot accept. He was such a shining light. He was such a shining star. He represented such nobility, something way beyond the ordinary singer or entertainer, that at the time, I don't think there was virtually no one in the black community who didn't believe that somehow or other this was a conspiracy, a racist conspiracy to kill Sam Cooke. And to this day, I could have had a 50-page appendix in the book with all the conspiracy theories, every one of them different, every one of them different in its details and different in its narrative, but essentially all proving that this is what happens when a proud black man becomes too big for his britches. And I think as a metaphor, both for that time and to some extent for this, it's absolutely true. But in terms of what happened, there's no evidence to support it. And what's most significant is that the people who knew Sam best, for the most part, believed that this is what happened, that the story was largely as it was told in court, and that Sam's behavior and his presence at the motel were simply not uncharacteristic of the Sam Cooke that they knew.
Now, you mentioned that there's a lot of conspiracy theories about what really happened to Sam Cooke the night he was killed. You say in your book that a lot of Sam Cooke's family blamed his wife Barbara for his death. In what way did they hold her responsible?
Well, Barbara Cooke and Barbara Campbell Cooke and the Cooke family. The Cooke family never approved of Barbara Campbell, who met Sam when she was barely 13 years old and Sam was about 17, fell in love with him. It was love at first sight, but it was, and it may have been love till the end of their lives. I mean, I don't doubt the attachment, but it was not a storybook tale. But the Cooke family never believed that Barbara was good enough for Sam. They felt that she was an adventuress, and whether she was too young at the time she met him, they simply didn't approve of her in any way. And when Sam married her, when their daughter was 6 years old, this was not something which made them any happier. Ultimately, by Barbara's own account, she and Sam were essentially each pursuing separate lives at the time of Sam's death. And Barbara was going out with a bartender named Al Woods at the time, and Sam had his own dates. So from the Cooke family's point of view, I think they saw Barbara as neglecting Sam. If he were happy at home, why would he be roaming around? But I think this is we're all protective of our families, of our children, and I think that this is not an this is not it. It's totally understandable what they felt, and I'm not arguing with their emotional reaction or with Barbara's emotional feelings either. But I think there's no objective evidence of anything other than that they felt that she wasn't the right person for Sam.
You interviewed many people for this book, including Sam Cooke's widow, Barbara, who hadn't spoken publicly before about Cooke. Why did she talk with you?
That I can't say. You'd have to ask Barbara. I mean, it was a remarkable. We spent 4 or 5 days, two sessions a day, and it was just, it was very intense and very detailed. But I can't say why she did. I had been seeking this interview for 5 or 6 years at the time, but why she finally consented to do it, I can't say.
Peter Guralnick speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2005 interview with Peter Guralnick, whose biography of singer Sam Cooke is called Dream Boogie.
One of Sam Cooke's greatest records was released on an album very late in his life, and it was released posthumously as a single. And the song is A Change Is Gonna Come. This is a song that he wrote. And before we actually hear it, what inspired this song, and what was the change of direction it represented in his music?
What inspired the song, A Change Is Gonna Come, was really everything that was going on in this country, in Sam's consciousness at that time with respect to the racial situation, with respect to the civil rights movement, with respect to the sit-ins. Specifically, Sam was inspired. He was on tour in North Carolina in the spring of 1963, and he and J.W. Alexander spoke with the student sit-ins and spoke quite extensively, and that was something which was very memorable for him. Within a couple of months of that, J.W. Alexander gave him the Bob Dylan album that had Blowing in the Wind on it, and Sam responded extremely, very directly to that song, and told J.W. what a great song it was, but it should have been written by a black man. It shouldn't, you know, it wasn't that he was very admiring of Bob Dylan, as he was of the Rolling Stones, of the Animals. I mean, his ears were wide open, and he heard new sounds, and he talked to Bobby Womack quite a bit about the way in which someone like Dylan put a song across. Bobby Womack said, "That's terrible. That guy can't sing." And Bobby said, "Listen to the words. Listen to the way he puts the songs across. Listen to the credibility he has. Listen to the way in which an audience will respond to it." He said, "That's the future." In any case, Sam, Blowing in the Wind was unquestionably influential. I think there's no doubt that the Birmingham demonstrations, and then the in the spring of '63, and then the March on Washington, meant an enormous amount to him. And right in the wake of that, Sam had his own. He had many moments. You couldn't escape the moments all through your. No African American could escape an awareness of the racial situation every minute of every day. But Sam's experience in Shreveport, when he got turned away from the motel and refused to back down, was an enormously traumatic event, just as it had been in 1949 when in Memphis he got picked up by the police for going into a whites-only park, and he got cuffed around by them and spoke of it to the end of his life. So that humiliation, that indignation, he wrote A Change Is Gonna Come, I would say, within a month or so. What scared Sam the most about the song was that it came to him almost unannounced. It came to him in a dream. And this is what he told everybody. He played the song for his wife Barbara, for J.W. Alexander, for Bobby Womack, for Leroy Kroom from the Soul Stirrers, and told them all essentially the same thing, which was, that the song had just come to him. It had come to him unannounced. Unlike other songs which he worked on, this song simply presented itself in its complete form, and it scared him. He didn't know where it was coming from. And he and Bobby Womack talked about it, and his feeling was it felt like death. And I can't really interpret what that means. I mean, I don't know whether it was the sense that he was not in control of what he was saying. It's a beautifully written, it's a beautifully crafted song, both the melody and the lyrics. And it's typical of Sam in the sense that rather than being yoked to a specific event, it starts from a generality, from a saying that can apply, a change is going to come that can apply to almost anything. And it's the reason, I think, that the song has continued to have currency all these years.
Do you think that if Sam Cooke had lived, that A Change Is Gonna Come would have been the start of a new direction for him, a new, more socially engaged type of song?
You know, I think the thing about Sam is that you need a new word. I mean, you think about the bifurcated personality. Well, with Sam, you need a multiple of bi that would represent 20. He really intended to go in every direction at once, and I think one of those directions would have been, you know, a more socially conscious one. And the fact that in that same year, in 1964, he started the first of what were intended to be a series of soul stations. He called the Soul Station Number One, which were kind of neighborhood as storefront locations, which would offer talented but sort of disaffected black youth the opportunity to come in, to try out, to rehearse, along with the idea of doing some things that were more socially conscious. He had committed to doing a concert, civil rights, a concert for Dr. Martin Luther King. But at the same time, he also intended, he had just signed a movie contract, he intended to go to Las Vegas. All of these things, in a sense, for most people, would cancel each other out. And you would tend to think, well, if he goes in that direction, he can't possibly go in this other direction. That means he won't do this thing. But in Sam's mind, I think he believed he could do it all. He could appeal to everyone across the board. And he was not inclined to limit himself in any way. But what it would have meant in practical terms, would the Las Vegas, the sort of the glitz, the Sammy Davis Jr. approach, would that have canceled out the direction he was going with A Change Is Going to Come, or even with a song like Keep Moving On? I think there's no way of telling. At the end of his life, he literally was moving in about 7 or 8 different directions.
Peter Guralnick, thank you so much for talking with us about Sam Cooke.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Peter Guralnick speaking with Terry Gross last year. His biography of Sam Cooke, Dream Boogie, has just been released in paperback.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long, long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes it will.
Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the independent film Mutual Appreciation. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Funny Haha, the first film by the 29-year-old director Andrew Bujalski, made a lot of critics' top 10 lists in 2004. Quite a feat for an independent film made with a minimal crew, a loose script, and the director's friends. Bujalski's new film, Mutual Appreciation, features Justin Rice, lead singer for the indie pop band Bishop Allen. The film is playing now in New York and Los Angeles and will open in other cities this fall. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
I thought about walking out in the first 20 minutes of Andrew Bujalski's micro-budget 2004 film Funny Haha. It seemed artless, aimless, like a slice of life that hadn't been sliced thinly enough. But Bujalski's free-floating comedies of manners, like Funny Haha, which is on DVD, and Mutual Appreciation, which is just opened, turn out to be shapely and cunning and indelible. In their naturalistic and low-key way, they capture the rudderlessness of a generation, of young people fearful of defining themselves, who don't know their own feelings, let alone how to communicate them to others. The protagonist of Funny Haha is Marnie, played by Kate Dollenmayer. She's a 23-year-old between jobs and quietly smitten with Alex, played by Christian Rutter, who's just broken up with his girlfriend. Does Alex like her? He might, but he's adorably diffident in a way that comes to seem calculated. That said, Marnie doesn't communicate her affections very forcefully. She drinks a lot at parties. She lies around. She floats. Floating, indecision, the indefinite, the non-action is set outside Boston in midsummer and has a midsummer formlessness, the languor you feel in those hazy dog days before the sudden sharpness of fall. After a while, the passivity becomes very amusing, and Dollenmayer more and more fun to watch. She's the sort of beauty whose self-effacing vibe would make her less than magnetic to really handsome guys and madly irresistible to nerds who think that maybe they'd have a shot. The nerd here is played by Bujalski himself, and he's cringeworthy, so self-deprecating it would be a sign of self-disrespect for Marnie to end up with him. In Mutual Appreciation, the protagonist, Alan, played by Justin Rice, is a little more defined, although he's still a floater. He's a singer-songwriter who's just arrived in New York with no job, no band, and with an income we later learn from his parents. He spends much of his time hanging out with his old friend Lawrence, played by Bujalski, and Lawrence's girlfriend Ellie, played by Rachel Clift. They seem grateful to have him around for company. They ply one another with beer, lots and lots of beer, and even hang out on the bed together, Alan in the middle, the threesome somehow looking both comfortable and anxious over their vaguely sexual mutual appreciation. Here's the opening scene, just Alan and Ellie on that bed, making small talk.
I'm sorry I'm being such a bad hostess.
You're not being a bad hostess, don't worry about it.
I don't know. This guy at work, Julian,
He
says that I have an iron deficiency.
Are you vegetarian?
Yeah.
I knew this woman once who was a vegetarian, and she was fine for 10 years, and then all of a sudden, her iron deficiency kicked in. She was so tired that on the way to the doctor, she had to pull over, take a nap.
Well, did she ever make it to the doctor?
Oh, yeah. She's had a nap twice.
And so she takes her iron pills and she's fine now?
She's fine. She started eating meat.
There's an attraction there, but action is a long time in coming, and there isn't much of it. Still, the exchanges are deft and amusing. As Alan, Rice is a mouth breather with a dazed affect. He might be Jerry Seinfeld's less finicky kid brother. It's a shock when he plays and sings with passionate intensity. We've had no indication that he's anything but a dilettante with a sense of entitlement. That's a knock on Bujalski, that his characters exist in a vacuum, with few references to culture or politics. But one artist's vacuum is another's poetic distillation, and there's something about Mutual Appreciation that spoke more directly to my inner slacker than any film since, well, Funny Haha. By slacker, I don't mean idler. I mean the part that avoids commitment yet longs for something other than chaos, something rooted. Watching the movie, I had two irreconcilable urges, to get blotto and to clean my office. With its half-hearted breakups and halting declarations, Mutual Appreciation is a tapestry of indecision that is, once you get on its curious wavelength, hugely entertaining. The piece de resistance is a scene in which a drunk Alan, in search of a late-night party, stumbles into an apartment where three young women, among them Kate Dollenmayer, sit chatting in dime-store wigs. They fall on Alan like nymphs out of Greek myth. They coerce him into a dress. They make it impossible for him to ignore his own formlessness. It's funny, haha, and like all the work of this brilliantly original young filmmaker, funny strange.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. This week, the great tenor saxophonist Sonny Rollins celebrated his 76th birthday. We're closing with one of his recordings. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Wild Ducks Flying Backward, the short writings of Tom Robbins, now in paperback. From the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at wkkf.org. And from BMW, where ideas are everything. And as an independent company, they have the freedom to let those ideas live on. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Before he was stopped, Pakistan's AQ Khan was the world's leading black market dealer in nuclear technology, selling nuclear secrets to Iran, North Korea, and Libya. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Gordon Carrera, author of Shopping for Bombs, Nuclear Proliferation, Global Insecurity, and the Rise and Fall of the AQ Khan Network. Join us for the next Fresh Air.